In the last 3 years, the U.S. has ramped up its partnerships in the Indo-Pacific as it continues to counter China's influence in the region. Now, the same goal may be shared to a certain extent by countries that align their objectives with that of the United States. Now, given the context, what do we make of the recent joint summit between the leaders of the U.S., Japan, and the Philippines? And what are the key takeaways from the Biden-Kishida agreements? For further insights, we connect with Professor Kim Byung-joo of the Hankuk University of Foreign Studies. Good morning, Professor Kim.
Good morning.
It feels like we just spoke to you recently.
I think we are doing it almost every day, it feels like.
A lot of grounds to cover, so we absolutely need your insights more than ever. So
thank you.
Let's get started. It must be said that it is a first ever. They say the U.S.-Japan-Philippines summit last week launched a new barrier against China's expansion in the South and East China Sea. Could you maybe start us off by explaining the nature and the significance of this summit?
Last Thursday, when we saw, U.S. President Biden and Japanese Prime Minister Kishida and also Philippines President Marcos, Ferdinand Marcos, standing together in Washington, that was quite interesting. I mean, we have seen different kinds of U.S. efforts to lay kind of barriers against China's expansion in the region. We have seen, for example, AUKUS, Australia, UK, and the United States, the security alliance being formed recently. And then we saw Quad. This hasn't become as strong as AUKUS, but still with the participation of India, Japan, Australia, and the United States, this security cooperation body was also very interesting, important development in the Asia-Pacific area. But now, ever more tightly, this kind of trilateral alliance being set up against China's expansion is very noticeable because when we say Japan and Philippines, these are two countries that actually have territorial disputes with China, right? Mm-hmm. For example, in South China Sea, Philippines has dispute over the Spratly Islands, and the East China Sea, Japan has dispute with China over Senkaku Island. So these are a lot more directly involved countries in terms of regional activities and expansionist behaviors of China in the region. So this is more direct. This is much more direct and immediate. And so that's why it caught the eyes of many experts here when they saw the heads of the three states, U.S., Japan, and Philippines, standing together talking about this kind of new form of alliance. Mm. This is kind of like a typical U.S. strategy under Biden administration, using what they call small size multilateral bodies like AUKUS, right? Three,
right.
And then Quad, four, and then this one again, three. Smaller size multilateral bodies countering China. You know, kind of like a lattice-like, layer by layer, formation. And so they're quite powerful here. And they were talking about actually these three countries, U.S., Japan, and Philippines, their coast guards, improving interoperability and, doing the joint exercise and even possibility of officials and personnel from Japanese and Philippine side joining U.S. Coast Guard ships, getting on board and then riding together and doing, joint drills and so on. So this is very, forthcoming and a strong form of cooperation that has risen in this part of the world, we have to say.
So unlike a single alliance, NATO most notably, the U.S. continues to form these smaller overlapping partnership, as you've said, lettuce layers.
Right, exactly. It's a very interesting development.
All right. We also want to take our listeners' attention to the Japan-U.S. bilateral summit. What were the key results of the Japanese Prime Minister Kishida's state visit to Washington?
Right. We had our state visit, Korea's president, but Kishida's state visit your...
All I remember is American Pie, Professor Kim.
That's important.
It is important.
I don't think Kishida actually offered anything that could measure up to singing American Pie. Maybe he's not as good singer, who knows, but he didn't try that. And obviously, it was the biggest splash. And actually, you know, like in terms of cultural diplomacy and then personal diplomacy, singing that song, I think, was a really good thing. Mm. And Americans talking about it. Yeah, so it worked pretty well. And Kishida did not succeed in offering a kind of like a matching kind of act this time. But his visit, state visit, in terms of its scope, was as comprehensive as what we saw during Korea's summit meeting with the United States last time. Last Wednesday, when we were having general elections here, Kishida was having his state visit programs taking place in Washington. Of course, sitting down together with Biden for summit and also giving speech to the U.S. Congress, basically. Mm. And those were very important actions a key ally can do. And he was very forthcoming in terms of bold, I guess, in terms of what Japanese prime minister have said in the past. In the considering the history this time, he was very, very strong. He called China's external stance and military actions as unprecedented and the greatest strategic challenge to international peace and stability, and said he's very against any revision or changes to the status quo. And so very strong words delivered to U.S. Congress. And together with President Biden, he was talking about very wide scope of cooperation, bilateral cooperation. For example, on the military side, extended information sharing capabilities being built up between Japanese Self-Defense Force and the U.S. military, and then cybersecurity systems being set up to have both countries working closer together. And, you know, the economic business issues on critical minerals and, you know, the new energy side, all these different kind of, you know, announcements were coming up. Microsoft's artificial intelligence related investment in Japan and Toyota's battery production related investment in the United States. And they were all discussed. And one thing interesting that we noticed is that Kishida also mentioned that he is interested in having talks with Kim Jong-un. And Biden supported the idea. And so that's something we should take a note of. We've seen a lot of moves north of the border, Kim Jong-un's sister talking about Kishida wanting to visit there. And then all of a sudden she turned around and she said, we don't need him. And, you know, a very interesting North Korean behavior. And we thought something was coming. And but I guess we have to say it was confirmed in Washington, in the words of Kishida, that he's interested in talking with Kim Jong-un. So that was very interesting. There were other, you know, brighter issues, but it's, you know, we have to manage our time here. So there are more interesting things. But, you know, summit meetings have long list of achievements. And indeed, this one had really, really long list of things that had happened.
Right. I mean, we're talking about dozens of new agreements. You alluded to military, economic. Those are probably the most pressing. And then there's climate and space issues. But you're right, to manage time.
Right.
We'll leave it there for now. Speaking of time, timing of these summits always come into question. So from a purely strategic perspective, shouldn't Japan have waited until after the November U.S. presidential election? What do we make of Japan's timing in this summit?
That's a really important question. Seems like November is not that far from now. And, you know, like they could have waited. And so it looks like the state visit itself seemed to be very close to the end of Biden, what many people hope to be Biden's first presidency, if there is a second one. But anyway, you know, very close to the end of it. And then why is this happening here? Different thoughts here. We know Kishida has possible re-election bid, when is it, like September? You know, LDP, Liberal Democratic Party in Japan, is holding internal election to select their party leader. In that case, if Kishida runs, he will have to run for re-election within his party as the prime minister, you know, like head of the party, ruling party in Japan becomes Japanese prime minister. So party election in September. We still are not sure whether Kishida is going to run again or not. Mm. And there are different people talking about different possibilities and possibly other candidates challenging him and so on. But no matter what, Kishida's official ending of his term for now is actually because of that September. So that's coming together with it. Uh-huh. And so some people are saying, well, you know, since Kishida is not sure whether he's going to be running or not, this might make sense. That could be one of the calculations on his side.
Mm.
But you know, more broadly, what we're saying here is that Japan as a whole, then Japanese government and diplomats and so on, they may be thinking that actually, you know, unlike what many people are talking about it, as they think seriously about it, Biden's second victory may be quite possible. And they might have thought it looks more likely than Trump's second victory this time in November. Because we see, as we mentioned in this program before, Trump has a serious money problem financing his campaign because of much of his money, campaign money, is going to his legal fees. And now different experts on the Democratic side and the side are raising issue about that. Can a candidate actually spend their campaign money for their personal legal defense or not? It's becoming its own scandal.
Right.
One way or not, Trump is running out of money, and U.S. politics, money is everything.
Mm-hmm.
On top of it, abortion issue is surfacing now, as it had been predicted.
Mm.
Just like immigration is a critical blow to Biden presidency, abortion is a critical blow against Trump candidacy. A lot of people believe, because half of, you know, population, female voters, voting against Trump if he advocates, canceling what has been achieved in terms of giving women's the right for abortion.
Right.
So the real risk may be ahead. Some of the Japanese foreign policy experts might have decided. So that's one thinking. And if they have Kishida again back into office in November, or someone else as a new prime minister, they may be thinking that they'll repeat what they did last time when Trump was elected.
Mm.
We remember this. We have this visual image of Abe, Japanese sitting prime minister at that time, flying to New York and running into Trump Tower.
Yeah,
when Trump was just the president elect, he was not in the White House.
Mm.
And Abe was meeting with Trump, and it worked very, very well. So they have a playbook to handle Trump presidency. So it looks like it's a sign of confidence in dealing with two different scenarios.
Professor Kim, you already touched upon a little bit, but maybe you have more points to make. Some pundits have pointed to Kishida's domestic political desperation given the timing of the summits. Can you maybe elaborate on that analysis?
Yeah, that's really important to touch upon here, because I already mentioned September party election. But for that, approaching September party election, what we know is Kishida's approval rating is really, really, really low. And he's reaching his lowest point in his prime ministership, around or even, I don't know, close to below 20%. That's very serious. And so a lot of people were saying maybe the reason why he was having a state visit is not because he's going to finish his prime ministership this time and will not have another chance and he wants to have it towards the end of it. That's not it, they're saying.
They want
opposite.
To
actually raise, right? Exactly. They want to raise his visibility and raise approval rating at home by having this successful state visit. So that's one. And actually, you know, like when is that? Today? Next week? No, about 2 weeks from now, they have actually local by-election for House of Representatives. Not local, the by-election. House of Representatives in three districts areas, Tokyo and Nagasaki and Shimane. And the polls show he's already behind. LDP is losing seats in Tokyo and Nagasaki. And they at least have to have Shimane seat regained. And so this is a last-ditch effort, and they're really hoping that this state visit will at least help LDC gain seats in Shimane, even if they lose their seats in Tokyo and Nagasaki. So there is an ample portion of domestic political calculation included in making this decision of having summit this time, for sure.
Mm. And finally, Professor Kim, looking at last week's decisions made by the Philippines and Japan to hold these summits, what kinds of implications should Korea draw or take away?
The thing is, when we see the map, Philippines, Taiwan, Japan, they're drawing clear lines here and saying we're on this side of the line together with the United States.
Right.
That's what these countries are doing. And South Korea is outlier in a way, saying, well, yes, we are firmly with the United States, but the domestic politics, there are politicians who are saying other things here. So I think we will continue to have a debate going forward. And, you know, so this case reminds us that Korea has difficult public choice to be made, collective choice to be made together in terms of what do we do about so-called the new Cold War, and what kind of stance should we have. During the campaign, Korea's general election campaign, you know, that ended last week, we heard some of the key political figures talking certain things about China and so on, right? And Japan and so on. I think one thing that we should keep in mind is that diplomacy, foreign affairs and stuff looks like it's not that complicated, simple, but it is. And experience really matters. So I'm not saying people like me should make a difference, not necessarily, but really seriously, what I'm hoping is academics without experience or practice, they're dangerous. So in my own view, even previous administration, Moon government, they did a good job keeping some of the really seasoned and experienced diplomats in place, key positions, like Jeong Yong, the last foreign minister of the Moon government. He did a wonderful, tremendous job steering Korea's foreign policy because he's such a seasoned professional. But at certain points, we saw Moon government hiring some of the academics who spend their life in their research rooms, flipping through papers and stuff, ideologues talking about wild ideas. That's very dangerous. So no matter what happens in Korean politics and debate about diplomacy, and no matter which government comes in the future, I'm just hoping that in diplomacy and foreign policy, we really have to rely on the people who have built their careers and experience on the field. You know, the academics who've been talking about things, you know, reading their books, we have to watch out.
I mean, academics are very important to discussions, but who carries out this practice, as you've said? I mean, if there are cautionary tales we can learn from, maybe there are important takeaways there too. Thank you so much, Professor Kim. As always, we've run out of time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We'll see you next week.
Okay, we'll do.
If you're listening to our program using the podcast service, just a reminder that we do go live Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. Korea Standard Time. So tune in and help us make the show more informative by giving us your input. See you bright and early on Good Morning Seoul.